Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am not Michael Walker.
Because that's me. And I'm not Mark Bigney.
Because that's me. We're going to be talking about board games this week. Just a quick follow-up from our discussion last week. Several users were appalled at the fact that we had an entire discussion about long games.
They were disgusted.
They were disgusted, revolted, and appalled and chagrined that we discussed long games and did not talk about Mage Knight. But it was also pointed out by another supporter that, of course, we were talking about Mage Knight the entire time because all those other games are basically Mage Knight anyway. Look, it's all the Zen merge. It's one with everything.
They should have assumed.
It's like, clear. It was clear from the subtext. Yeah. I'm actually a little disappointed that they weren't able to detect
clues. They're not regular listeners. That's the problem, right?
Well, no, you got to put it together like the Da Vinci Code is the issue. And so we're going to be talking about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to be talking about our feature game as voted on by our patrons, Rumble Nation, which, as I understand it, is a simulation of the Greasers fighting the Sox.
Oh, I played the wrestling game. Is that not what we're talking about? I thought we were playing the WWE.
No. This is about the Outsiders, the Rumble and the Outsiders.
Oh. All right.
Okay.
That'll be interesting.
We'll sort it out. It'll come out in the wash. I'm sure I'll be able to edit it together somehow. So, Walker, what'd you play last week?
Mark, I got to play a new micro-macro game called Micro-Macro Kids Crazy City Park. I was going to an event. I knew there'd be children there. And as soon as they showed up, I said, I brought a game just for you guys. And sure enough, they said they were ready. You know, there was no pressure. It's like, if you want to play it, come and get me.
Of course. That's how you do it. Yeah.
So they came and got me, and we set it up. And it's very much like Micro Macro. The clue, and for those who have never played Micro Macro, it's sort of like a clue like Where's Waldo? You know, you have to follow the map along, and there's multiple, like, we'll say Jimmy robbed a bank, and you'll be able to trace Jimmy through this giant map as he goes down the street and see him.
This is Jimmy not carrying the sack of cash. We can see where he came from. This is Jimmy carrying the sack of cash. We can see where he ran away afterwards. Yeah, clue with a plot. Narrative clue.
It's just, the difference isn't just that they're a little bit easier. The difference is they also come with these clear bingo chips so you can mark all the different clues so you can go backtrack to see where you were. It also, the difference is instead of having all these wax envelopes with all these different cases, it's a book that you slowly go through and has all these different cases. And it did exactly what I wanted. You watch their faces as they see like the third instance of Jimmy walking down the street. It's like, there he is again. And you know, they all get it, you know, as they grasp how the system works. And anyway, it was a great hit. Micro Macro Kids.
I'm glad that the kids version is good because I have had a lot of success with Micro Macro with children as well. The only shortcoming is that some of the more complicated cases really do tend to tax the attention spans and/or deductive or inductive abilities. Getting age-appropriate cases is not a problem. All the other ones, other than Crime City, the original, All In, Full House, have age-appropriateness ratings for the cases. And that's great, because that was pretty much my only misgiving with Micro Macro. It's a great kids game, especially if you have to, and I definitely approached it with the right mindset, you have to accept that the map is going to get a little bit wrinkled, a little bit ratty, torn a couple places maybe. It's all right.
Just make sure you don't have any crayons close by. Because when you have a black and white map, like drawing like that, and you know,
the temptation is
strong. The child urge will strike, and the colors will come out.
Would you characterize the age range of the children you played with? I'm just curious.
I think they're like 7.
Okay.
If I had to guess. And so Micro Macro Kids Crazy City Park is designed by Johannes Sitch and put out by Lucky Duck Games.
I get to play Good Puppers. Good Puppers is, by full disclosure, my friend Chris Cheslick of Asmodee Games. Recently, successfully crowdfunded is the sequel Good Puppers 2. And I have pledged for that and waiting for it. I'm perfectly happy with the base game, though, frankly, because there's tons and tons of variety. The way Good Puppers works is it is tableau building and combo building stripped down to its barest essentials in a very tight, very adorable package. Because every card is a doggo, even the doggos that are meows, that are totally not sneaky doggos trying to pretend to be doggos.
They would never do that.
And there's a combination of both the suit, which corresponds to the breed, and a special power that is common across all the breeds. But some of them have these powers that trigger as they come into play, and they're trying to bury bones and upgrade bones, which are points. And at the end of the game, each breed has its own scoring condition. Like, for example, one is if you have a full 6 breeds with bones, then all the bones under that breed get upgraded twice, which is great. That is a significant point bonus, so there's something to score for. So you're immediately juggling a variety of different scoring conditions pulling you in different directions, all with relatively simultaneous play and a very brisk playing time, even compared to something quick like Point Salad. Point Salad is, again, trying to strip this down to its essentials, but I find it very, very mechanical and calculational in comparison. Good Puppers is just the right level of complexity and interest for me, because as far as fillers go, it does capture a lot of the appeal of some of those more dense combinatoric tableau-building Euros, but it moves along at such a brisk pace and is so adorable and is not quite as bluntly, dully calculations like, okay, well, this carrot's worth 5. If I flip it over, it's going to be worth, quick mental calculation, 17. Okay, let's flip it over, etc. Which, frankly, I don't object to doing arithmetic, but it's not the primary way I'd like to interface with board games. So I was very happy to get Good Puppers out to the table. Still, every time the stickers come out, people ooh and ah. Someday someone might take the stickers and apply them, but for now they're pristine in the box because, yes, I'm that kind of dull collector. That's Good Puppers by Chris Cheslick of the Mighty Games, 2021.
I think the expansion will be great for people who tend to play this a lot, so, you know, bringing a rash of different abilities, and I think it'll just be very interesting just to go through them.
Don't want dogs with rashes. Pass on those.
It's true. It'll be like after they've seen the game out in the wild and played.
No, these are domestic dogs. I don't think you understand what that is true. And I shouldn't. I did happily pledge not just to support my friend, but also because having seen Chris's development work on One Deck Dungeon, right? I played One Deck Dungeon. I enjoyed it. And then the next base set came out and I pledged for that. And then it really showed him opening the system up and really experimenting with some of these same ideas. And so, yes, I'm optimistic that Good Puppers 2 might have an interesting variation on the core set of powers introduced in Good Puppers. And yes, for people who played Good Puppers to death, might want to move on to the next one after having put the first one down.
Yikes.
No, you're done with the game. You put it down.
Rex!
When the game... I don't understand what you're talking. You're so confused, Walker.
Mark, we got, speaking of putting them down, we got 23 knives back to the table. This is designed by Tyler J. Brown and published by Play to Z Games. And Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar.
And so what you're doing in 23 Knives is you're populating this hidden stack of doves and knives, which will cancel each other out, and then after they cancel each other out, you need to have 23 or more knives in order for Caesar to go down.
Because that was the number of conspirators. And because that's what it says in the rule book.
And at the same time, and the reason you populate this is because everyone has a hidden role. Either they're trying to kill Caesar, or they're not trying to kill Caesar, or they're trying to go down the middle and manipulate it at the last minute. And so it's a game of making people want to kill Caesar, and therefore, you know, making them, because whoever wants to kill Caesar the most, if Caesar dies, wins. And whoever wants to save Caesar the most, if he's saved, will win. And so it's this back and forth of making yourself either really good or really bad or right down the middle.
Yeah, so there's basically two axes upon which the game is hinging. One of them being whether or not Caesar is going to die, and then who is going to win of those factions when the final results are tallied. And so there's the stack of cards to determine Caesar's fate, as well as the tableau of loyalty cards that are usually mostly hidden or somewhat hidden in front of every individual player to determine the actual winner. Normally, in games of this ilk, where the game can end and there's a couple step test to determine which faction wins, then who wins inside the faction, but this can be reversed by somebody else. Normally, games of this ilk are surprisingly difficult to internalize. And you find yourself over the course of teaching the game several times reminding people, okay, well, if this happens, this person wins. If this other thing happens, somebody else wins. I've been surprised both times playing 23 Knives that has been relatively easily internalized. And that's good. Because I was expecting something else. Both times when explaining the game, actually, I've been like, so you get it? And they're like, yeah, I get it. We can move on. Because, again, normally this is a sticking point. And so then there's the question of the balance of the victory conditions and the balance of intrigue. Because if there's, it's a classic conundrum in board game design. If there's too much intrigue, you don't feel like you know what's going on. And so you feel like you're doing things relatively arbitrarily, or you just ignore any attempted subterfuge and you just go all out from the beginning, which sometimes is the dominant strategy anyway. So why have the intrigue? This is what's undone a lot of other games of this ilk, whether it's War of Whispers or any other nominal hidden identity games. I am very impressed, all told, at the balancing acts that 23 Knives does. I found the victory conditions to be tense and pretty close, both games, both in terms of whether the opportunists can reverse the victory condition, or in terms of the competition about whether Caesar lives or dies in the first instance. I found the competition over who is going to be the probable victor based on those results to be just transparent enough. Like, I have a pretty good idea of what's going on without having a perfect idea of what's going on. And so it gives me just enough to go on, but I feel like there's enough cover for people to make misdirection. All of those things are really well done. The only real knock that I have, well, two misgivings that I've got about 23 Knives, and then I'll be very curious to hear your thoughts, because I got the strong impression you did not enjoy it at all. Number one, I think the game could be about 15 minutes shorter. It's about 75 minutes. I think it wants to be about 60. And that is partially as a result of number two, the actual actions that you do aren't as interesting as the meta state of the game. Mostly what you're doing is you're just accumulating cards of the two types and playing cards of those two types. And this is attenuated through a location system. And it's not the coolest part of the game.
I agree. Like I said, it's not for me, but I can see why it's interesting. I really enjoyed what I could do within the game, because what I did in our game, I was one of the sympathizers or one of the people
that loyalists, were, yeah.
Loyalists. And I could sense that the two people that wanted to kill Caesar knew that they each wanted to kill Caesar.
Yeah.
So they were battling out to see who wanted to kill Caesar the most. And so I realized that if I could just feed into that, they would be busy battling each other. And then me and the other loyalist could just worry about feeding doves into the dagger pile. Therefore, Caesar not dying and their battle between each other would be pointless.
Yeah, no, you did a good job.
That part
yeah.
was very interesting.
Yeah. I feel like with a better set of actions, or maybe one extra element of spice, maybe... that 23 Knives, I think, could really sing. As it is, I am pro 23 Knives. I enjoy playing it. I think it gets done what it seeks to accomplish. And as I say, it balances a number of very difficult things to balance very well. But the moment-to-moment gameplay is not quite as gripping as it could be, because mostly the actions you're doing are pretty bonesy.
I think that's my biggest problem with it. With me, it was just like, I need to get certain cards. Okay, so I need to go there, but my hand limp, you're only allowed to have 6 cards in your hand between the fate cards and the...
Sway cards.
And so it was mostly just, okay, well, I need these cards, but I don't want it because people can raid the discard pile. So while I don't want to just throw all these knives into the discard pile because they're gumming up my hand,
yeah.
So I want to get them into the burn pile, but burn piles, you can only put one in at a time. So it was just this.
That is perhaps the most interesting part of the card management. Otherwise, it's relatively straightforward. Which kind of actually feeds into my first objection. I think one of the reasons why 23 Knives isn't quite as brisk as it wants to be is because it has this admittedly interesting element of there are these cards that correspond to the faction that you don't want, that help Caesar live if you want him to die or help him die if you want him to live. And dealing with those cards is hard because if you discard excess cards as a function of your hand limit, anybody can go get them. Anyone can go raid the discard pile. It's one of the available actions. It's very straightforward. And so managing what to do with this garbage that ends up with your hand is admittedly super cool, but it does tend to lead to a kind of vaguely stalling dynamic, which tends to contribute to the game length.
True. And another thing that we didn't talk about, while the turns are happening, there are these laws that are being passed, and they could force you to play cards out of your hand. So if you like start hanging on to these high dagger cards, some of these laws might make you either A, put them into the discard pile, or force you to put them into the pile. So there's always worrying about getting them out of your hand for these reasons as well.
Yeah, a little bit. If they managed to keep the pacing up and had a little bit more influence along the lines of those laws, just things to shake up the fundamental formula to make you look around the table and infer how people are going to vote and determine where they're going to go and react accordingly. That, I think, would have definitely added considerably to 23 and a half. As it is, these are minor complaints. These are just added elements that I would have liked that I think might have helped make the tastes of more people. But as it is, I thoroughly enjoy 23 Knives.
And so did the rest of the table. You know, me aside, everyone else at the table seemed to enjoy it very much.
So that's 23 Knives, designed by Tyler J. Brown, published by Play to Z this year after successful crowdfunding. Got to play Team 3, so let's tell a story about Jenga Maker, Walker.
Oh, do tell.
We love Jenga Maker here at So Very Wrong About Games. It is a glorious game. It is all too easily dismissed by people who think they don't want to play baby games for babies. But these are people who miss out on some of the finer things in life. Among the finer things in life, Jenga Maker. The biggest problem with Jenga Maker, though, is that it is for 4 or 6 players, effectively. You don't really want uneven numbers of teams. You can't play, you absolutely cannot play with a team of 1 player. And so, I mean, maybe you could play with 5 if you really wanted to, I suppose. But you definitely cannot play with a flexible player count. And that is one of the main reasons why we don't play more Jenga Maker, because A, some people dismiss it, and B, it is of a restricted player count. And that's one of the reasons why I sought out Team 3. There are 2 versions of Team 3, Team 3 Green and Team 3 Pink. They're effectively the same, except they have additional modules to make the game harder. This has, in my experience, not been one of the key challenges when playing Team 3. And I thought that Team 3 would have a much more flexible player count because it claims to be for 3 to 6 players. If anything, Team 3 has a more restrictive player count, but one of the ideal player counts is 3. So if you've got Jenga Maker and Team 3, you're covered for like 3, 4, and 6. Which is a pretty good setup. So here's the difference between Team 3 and Jenga Maker. In Team 3, you effectively play as 3 monkeys. I prefer to think of them as gibbons, of course. Gibbon representation. 1 player gets to see the pattern that you want to build out of blocks. They, however, are not allowed to speak or touch the blocks. Another player is allowed to speak and is allowed to see things. They're not allowed to touch the blocks or see the pattern. So all they get to do is just use all their available senses and relay the gestures that the first player has to the third player, who actually gets to touch the blocks, but they're not allowed to open their eyes. So one player is giving gesticulating frantically in an effort to communicate what's on the card. The second player is attempting to verbalize those commands to a third player who is blindly fumbling around with the blocks. And so it's a pure co-op. You have you're operating against the timer in order to build these admittedly very, very simple shapes. So you can't, I mean, part of me wishes you could play Team 3 with the Jenga Maker components or vice versa, but you really can't. Jenga Maker is, part of the joy of Jenga Maker is that you get these lovely little representational block arrangements that are shockingly evocative of a swimmer or a library or a whale or whatever. Whereas in Team 3, they're not even attempting to explain what these things are meant to look like. These patterns come in various difficulty levels. So the easiest difficulty level is just you're taking these plastic blocks and you're arranging them in very simple arrangements. The more difficult ones play with perspective so that the block may be hidden by other blocks or it might be on its side so you can only see various parts of it. I can't even imagine getting to that because even the easiest ones tend to be very, very challenging in Team 3. And Team 3, in this instance, I pulled it out in the context where there were only 3 of us. And these were, to some extent, Jenga Maker veterans. And so it was this bizarre sort of meta-commentary on dismissiveness because these Jenga Maker veterans were being dismissive of Team 3. So it's like, no, well, let's give it a try. It was very promising. I really enjoyed it. It was super cool. And I like being forced to flex these different kind of muscles. I mean, yeah, we love dexterity games, partially for that reason. And now there's this other unique set of social challenges of getting people to build this thing that you can see or building this thing that you can't see, case depending. And it's just super enjoyable. I like playing with blocks. What do you want? It's just cool.
It's just fun.
So I thoroughly enjoy Team 3. When I've got 3 people together, it's an excellent filler. Takes hardly any time at all because, again, you're under a time pressure. And maybe someday we'll be able to progress past the super intro level patterns and get to the slightly more difficult stuff and or the differing modules, because I do have Team 3 Pink and Team 3 Green, but there's been no effective difference between them because I'm not good enough for the fancy stuff yet. Who knows? The way you play with more than 3 players, by the way, is you have the 3 roles, and then the people who don't have the 3 roles watch the people with the 3 roles. This is not ideal.
You can have six and have two teams.
Yeah, there are versions for this
and shout over top of each other.
No, that's not quite the rules in Team 3 for a six-player game. But yeah, there is a six-player variant. Honestly, with six, I think I'd rather play Jenga Maker with two teams of three. That works. That can work better. So that's Team 3 by Alex Cutler and Matt Fantastic. Matt Fantastic is a great name for a game designer. Published by Brain Games in 2019.
I got to play Marabunta. This is designed by Reiner Knizia and put up by Space Cowboys. And it is essentially a roll and write. I say that very loosely because you do roll dice and you do write on a dry erase board. But it's very much like an area control type game. You're going to be rolling a bunch of dice and drawing a tile. And the first player is going to divide these into two piles. And then the other player is going to pick a pile and carry out what's on the dice and maybe the tile if it's in the pile that they picked. And there's numbers on the dice and you're writing numbers on the map and you're trying to get the highest value of numbers in certain areas. And they're going to be worth a certain number of points based on another side of the die that makes each area worth more. And you're crossing off, you know, cupcakes, because this is ants fighting each other. So you're crossing off cupcakes that are going to get you more points. And then other sort of traditional roll and write, marking off areas, you know, parcels. And when you fill out all the parcels, you get a bonus. Anyway, it's a great two-player only roll and write type game that keeps you engaged the whole time and has the, you know, I split, you choose mechanic, which is amazing in this particular implementation. Marabunta.
Huge fan of Marabunta. Really, really well done. On the topic of Reiner Knizia, I got to play Raw. I got to introduce Raw to a couple of players. I have a bit of a problem, Walker. And that is, there are these individuals out in the world who need to be shown the greatness of some of the output of Reiner Knizia, specifically the output of Reiner Knizia around the turn of the century, which I maintain is unparalleled. And the problem is that I played some of these games 50, 60, 70 times. I'm not especially good at board games. But if you give me a 50, 60, 70 game advantage, especially in an auction game where it's difficult to evaluate the worth of a given lot when you just know the rules of the game and have no concept of how the tempo is going to go out, it is conceivable that over the course of the game, the other players may perceive that I may be doing better than they are. Again, I maintain that this is not by virtue of any sort of gift that I possess other than the good fortune of having played Raw so many times. I don't know how to introduce games with experiential advantage to new players without them feeling dispirited. It is a challenge. Now, in this case, the genius of Raw, and to a certain extent I had the same problem with Tigers and Euphrates a few weeks ago, the sheer quality of the game design is sufficiently good that even if someone is running away with things, you can perceive the core virtues of the game itself. I wish there were a better way to do it, though, frankly. But here we are. As it is, as I've said many times before, any Raw is good Raw. I'll take it at any player count, in any context, with any skill group. It is a marvelous, marvelous game and deserves to be enjoyed by more people.
Speaking of any Raw is good Raw, I got to play Raw the Dice Game, which really should be called Raw the Themed Dice Game, because it has very much nothing to do with Raw, really. Because if you're not going to have an auction, then it's not Raw.
Yeah, fair enough.
So what you're doing in Raw, the dice game, is you roll the dice. You might get some snakes, which I guess would be the chickens, and they go off to the side. They're usually bad things. And then you get other symbols, which just correspond to, you know, Raw-type stuff. You're getting, you know, monuments and or boat, you know, crops and floods, and you want to flood things. But the snakes, you don't get to re-roll, but if you get three snakes, then you get some points. And if you get even more snakes, then you start to curse people, which, you know, makes them all lose points while you don't. So it all sort of washes out at the end. But it is also the game timer. Because for every snake someone rolls, it moves the token up towards the end. But if they roll more than two snakes, then it doesn't move at all. And then you have to play three rounds. So unfortunately, the first round took so long because either some people were rolling no snakes or more than two, and that the marker just did not move. So they just kept rolling and rolling until finally the first round came to an end. and you score everything but the monuments, and you do this three times in total, and then the monuments will score at the end. And that's Raw the Dice Game.
So, in fairness, okay, first of all, they're not snakes, they're sun discs. But that's fine. They look a lot, awful lot like snakes.
I was told they were snakes.
That's fine. Did Sidewinder tell you they were snakes?
No.
Okay. The scoring is extremely evocative of Raw, and the push your luck element is
true.
Vaguely reminiscent of Raw, in fairness, I agree. But I'm very curious about what Ryan Knizia is going to do with his other version of Raw the Dice Game, namely Raw and Right. I haven't tried that yet. I'm very curious. And yes, the fact that every round can be of varying length is also very reminiscent of Raw, except in Raw, you're pulling tiles from a bag, and so the overall tempo of the game is kind of driven by the scarcity and the setup of the tiles in the bag, as opposed to Raw the Dice Game, where you could have three really, really, really short rounds, or all three rounds be really, really long, because it's just a function of how the dice come up.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was very good. I would play it again.
It is good, yeah. I mean, all the variations of Raw I've thoroughly enjoyed. There's Raw the Dice Game, there's also Priests of Raw. I don't think any of them are as good as the original.
No.
But I think that they're very interesting variants, frankly. Although, yes, Raw the Dice Game, calling it a variant is a stretching of the word. But, yeah, I played it when it came out. I enjoyed it. Glad you liked it. That was Raw the Dice Game by Ryan Knizia, published by Rio Grande Games in 2009. So I got exposed to something today. Walker shared with me the cultural artifact that is Moving Company. Moving Company is by Guo Jinhua and Hu Yang, published by Wales Entertainment this year. It's a scene and a half. So, let's start with the good. There are these very lovely cardboard moving trucks. And these very lovely pieces of cardboard furniture, complete with shelves, unnecessarily in some instances, that contribute to a very interesting geometry of how these pieces fit together. If you are going to make a dexterity game, whether it's stacking, whether it's flicking, anything like that, if your pieces are designed in such a way so as to have a novel means of interacting with each other, that is always a plus as far as I'm concerned. The king of this, from my perspective, it remains junk art, where there's this pool of objects, wood in some editions, plastic in others, that constantly present you with new ways that they fit together or interact or stack in a way that you didn't expect or balance in a strange way. Very, very carefully sourced and very interesting in terms of the geometry of the play state. And similarly, in the context of the Moving Company, not to the same extent, but you do have little cutouts that represent, you know, legs of chairs, and that kind of interacts with the side of the truck so you can hang things off the side. Walker did a truly avant-garde thing with a large bookshelf where somehow dangling over the edge of the truck bed. I don't know how you manage that. And then there are the rules. How would you characterize the rules, Walker?
No one can see the air quotes when you say rules.
Yeah, it's a thing. How would you characterize it, Walker?
I'd say that a couple guys got all these really cool components and then dished out a rule book in about an hour or so. It's saying random is not even giving it close to being how much randomness there is in this game.
Yeah, let's focus on my favorite variant, because there are the variants that are presented. Whereby, the goal is to stack all your furniture in the shortest stack possible. There is a very floppy ruler included with the game that folds the wrong direction, so it's constantly folding in on itself, so you can't see the numbers. Had they printed the numbers on both sides, or had they made the fold in the other direction, it would have been vastly easier, but no. Anyway, you take the die, and you roll the die, and the die will tell you how many furniture cards you have to stack. Now, you might be thinking, but Mark, you just said you wanted to have the shortest stack possible. Wouldn't you want to roll low? Yes. That is your first point of strategy. You want to low 5 rather than rolling 7. A clever player will tell you that. Noobs will tell you that 7 is a better number. They're wrong.
They are very wrong.
They're wrong. We're experienced board gamers, so we knew this. And then what you do is you take that many cards off the deck, which corresponds to the pieces of furniture. But Mark, you'd say, wouldn't you want the smaller, more easily stacked, less tall piece of furniture? Again, this is where strategy comes into play. Your noob will just say, oh, well, it's just cards as cards, but no. And if you pull the bookcase off that deck, you're a sucker.
They don't know how aerodynamics works, Mark. When you're traveling down the road with this moving truck, you need certain pieces of furniture.
Absolutely. So the first few rounds, I did not pull any bookcases. I felt very fortunate as a consequence. The last round, where you actually want the tallest possible truck, I pulled 3 of the 4 bookcases. It was great. So look, we've been saying for years, we love almost all dexterity games, but we acknowledge that vanishingly few of them resemble robust competitive experiences. Not, again, that we're super competitive. We just like the structure to be there so you feel like you're playing a game. And you feel like you're playing a well-designed game, a game that's reasonably fair, and you're going to succeed or fail based on the things that you do, not on the fact that I pulled 5 baby chairs and Chip the Third over there pulled 7 cards, 4 of them were bookshelves. Like, that's just the way of things, right? I wish that these components, just the box of the components with no rules, had been handed to the design team of Junk Art. Because Junk Art similarly takes this pool of great components and comes up with a whole bunch of different minigames. None of them feel half so random and arbitrary as any of the game modes in Moving Company. I thoroughly enjoyed playing Moving Company, but there is no even remote attempt at making a balanced game out of it.
No. There's, like, no real draw to go back to it too often. There's, like, that, you know, the memory is, like, that was fun. And it does take a very short amount of time as well. It's not as though you're stuck in this randomness for a long time.
Yes.
We played 4 rounds with all different game modes and 20 minutes tops.
With the different variants.
The very balanced and fair variants, yes.
How did you get those bookshelves to dangle off the edge of the truck bed?
I utilized the shelves that you thought were useless.
Okay.
I put the table in upside down into the bed of the truck, thereby exposing the legs and therefore being able to stick the bookshelves, you know, upside down onto the legs and holding them like a surfboard onto the truck. It was
well done. Mostly this is reminding me that I want to play Junk Art again.
That is true.
So that's Moving Company by Wales Entertainment. That's Wales the animal, not Wales the place. Published this year.
So Santorini is a 2-player game that I really love. And very recently, they brought out a sort of companion expansion called Santorini, The Riddle of the Sphinx. I know there are people right now tapping on the computer, but Mike, Santorini can be played with 3 or 4 players. No. Santorini is a great 2-player game. And you're trying to get your figure to the 3rd level of a building. And so it's this abstract sort of move and build. And so you're blocking and you're making, because you can only jump up 1 level at a time, so you can totally block people off on certain parts of the map. You're moving in and building a level higher so they can't get up, or putting a dome on a building, which just means it's not scoreable whatsoever. Long story short, Riddle of the Sphinx makes it a cooperative puzzle experience. So how it works is that it limits the number of building pieces that you are able to use. So it will populate the map with certain size structures that you need to build, and you only start with 2 building pieces and some god cards, and you need to be able to build all of these structures with limited pieces and utilizing the god cards to get you more pieces and getting it all done.
I think you have successfully described a minor nightmare for me. How was it, though?
It is fantastic.
That's great.
I love it. Huey loved it. We played where I think we're already at, like, mission 7 or something.
Nice.
There's also, like, a map. So they give you all these different objectives that you have to do. And each objective gives you a point. And then you fill in all these dots on this map, which get you different god cards that do different things. So the god cards are in this, like, sort of display. And it'll show you what piece they come with. So you'll take the god card, and anyone can use that piece. But if someone else uses the piece, then you won't be able to do the quest that is on the god card. Because only the person that has the card, if they do the quest that is pretty well using that piece that's on the thing, it's sort of like, you know, move up a level and build this piece. And then you achieve the quest. And it's almost every time, pick a building piece of your choice and add it to your pool.
So, I see.
So this is how you're getting more pieces. Now, unfortunately, the cooperative mechanic rears its ugly head, which is randomness, okay? Mm. And it leads into the title of the game. So, of course, you're going to get the random god cards that come up, and you might not get the pieces that you need that way, but you can work around that. The other thing is one of the actions you can take, so that sort of works into it as well, is the timing, right? Because someone needs a certain piece that's in the in the pool. And so it's like, well, on my turn, instead of moving and building, I'm going to take a god card, because that's one of the new actions you can do. And one of the other new actions you can do is the Riddle of Sphinx, which you're going to roll a 12-sided die. And there are sort of a little gem counter, right? So there's four different colors on the die. You know, let's say red, green, purple, and yellow. One of the tokens on the track is too wide. So if you roll that, then you've eliminated both of those colors. And what they let you do is just pick a piece of your choice and you put it in the pool. But now that token is gone. And if you roll either of those colors again, you lose one of your figures, of which you only have two.
Woof.
And if between the two players you lose two figures, you've lost that particular puzzle.
Right.
So, and unfortunately, based on some of the objectives that you have, like you can do like the ultra hard where, you know, you start with less pieces and you obtain all of the goals with still having god cards up in the queue, because it's not as though it's a giant deck of god cards. Sometimes you only have the three on display and you have to do everything with just those cards. And so once you do the quick math of all the pieces that you have to build and how many god cards you have, you see that you're going to have to roll that die multiple times. And it's just like, okay, well, let's just get those pieces out of the way.
Just see if we get the auto.
Yeah, because if we fail, then, you know, if we're trying for this particular heroic mode, then, you know, we're obviously just going to reset and start again.
Right.
Anyway, other than that, I very much love Riddle of Sphinx. Production is great. It's one of these spiral bound books, so you don't need the Santorini map. You just, you know, open up the book, all of the map is there, and you move your pieces around and build right on the map. Lots to like about it.
I'm generally indifferent to hostile towards positional abstracts. There's some that I really like. I really love Lacuna by CMYK, and I really like Quinn. But Santorini was very much one of those positional abstracts where I'm playing, it's like, oh, this is really well designed, and I hate it.
And I dislike it immensely.
Well, no, it's one of those things where it's like, this is super well put together. Obviously, it's visually appealing. The rule set is very tight. I can absolutely see the levels of tactics and strategy and the cat and mouse and all these other kinds of considerations, and I want nothing to do with it. And it's just a very, very well-designed instance of a kind of thing I don't enjoy.
Yeah, so if you're looking for a two-player abstract game, this is definitely up your alley. I would try Santorini out just by itself, and if you play it a lot and enjoy it, then Riddle of Sphinx is a no-brainer for me. It's super fun. The Riddle of Sphinx is designed by James Van Nierick and Paul Satzberg and put out by Roxley Games.
Oh, Gord was not involved.
He was not.
Huh. Interesting. Walker was very kind enough to show us the Crew Family Adventure. See, what happened was there's this man named Thomas Singh. Thomas Singh designed a game called The Crew, Quest for Planet 9, as well as The Crew, Mission Deep Sea. Utterly fantastic co-op trick-taking games that we love playing.
So I saw this, Mark. I know the of these other two crew games.
Yes.
And we love these two crew
it's
games.
It's true.
So when this, you know, popped up on our online retailer.
You told me that you encountered Thomas Singh in an alley, and he opened up his trench coat, and he had this game, and he said, "Hey, kid, I designed The Crew. You want another crew game?" And then he took all your lunch money.
And it says family, you know, Robinson, like it's going to be like a family Swiss Robinson themed adventure, trick-taking crew game that's going to bring you on this adventure. And then after I had ordered it, I thought, you know, family Robinson, maybe it just means it's going to be a family trick-taking game, and I don't know how's that.
See, going? Robinson wasn't anywhere in the promotions. You were the one who smuggled Robinson in.
No, that's a lie. And and so I read nothing into it other than it said The Crew and story. And it was going
to
be great.
I think in this instance, you are simultaneously the victim and the perpetrator. You do it to yourself, just you and no one else. Tom York was right all along. So you described it as Uno. That sounds about right,
yep.
Based on my limited understanding of how Uno works. Your goal in so there are various missions. Like the other crew games, there's a book full of missions. The first mission is borderline insulting.
Yes.
I remember the first mission in the other crew games to be close to insulting, but, you know, there was still something there. You need to play out certain cards. The entire deck is dealt out, and in order to follow someone else's card, you must match the number or the color. So, you know the green 7 needs to get played in order for the mission to be accomplished. So you don't have the green 7. So you can't play the green 7. So you look at your hand and you say, ah, but I have this red 7. I'll play this red 7. And the next player has the blue 7 or they don't. And there's a certain number of times you can pass and that's about it.
Yeah.
I mean,
and literally the only reason I think I'm talking about it now is just so...
Because we have a podcast?
So,
well,
the same mistake won't be made. Because I'm sure other people say, oh, a new crew game. Yes, please. And hit the button. Right? And unless you have children, I would not do that. This is not a game for you. This is definitely a very light children slash family card game with crew-like mechanics.
I'm not even sure it has crew. Well, I guess the communication is kind of like the crew. You can, once per round, show people a card you've got in your hand with no restrictions. The only part of confusion we had was the whole... It has a whole bunch of tracking cards, which for a lot of the missions just don't matter. And so we were arranging them in different ways. Like, is we supposed to... Are we... It's like, and like several times, we kept saying, it doesn't matter. We're allowed to play 8 cards. We need to do these 3 things before we play the 8 cards.
It also has this giant board where you're supposed to track what card was just played, which is also completely pointless, except for the special cards, which allow you to like do this odd diagonal move.
It allows you to track the cards you need to play. You can put little counters on them.
Yeah, you would need to reference the board in order to use your special card, where it says, you can play, you don't have to play the same color or the same number. You can go diagonally 3 times and over left twice, and then you can play that card instead.
Frankly, I'm surprised at how incredibly short the missions are. The setup isn't onerous, right? But you still have to shuffle 2 decks and deal them out. And many of the missions involve playing 6 cards total, across the entire table. I don't mean per player. I mean total. And so you're spending more time just cycling through the different missions, internalizing how the missions work. And one thing that is a minor knock against all of the crew games, I don't find the way they've laid out the missions to be particularly intuitive. I often find myself needing to cross-reference the rules between the mission book and the core book. And I find myself having a little bit more difficulty with that than I think I should in terms of internalizing how the mission special rules work. And given that the missions are so incredibly trivial, like you're playing 1 or 2 cards per player, you spend most of your time just wrestling with that as opposed to anything else.
Yep. Deep Sea is still the winner.
Absolutely. No question. The Crew. Family Adventure. I don't know about adventure. I mean, we just... Okay.
Hard pass.
Yeah.
Playdmore's Hot Streak, Mark. This is designed by John Perry and put it by CMYK. And this is a review copy that we got. It was at the event, so all new players but me. And it was... well received by everyone. There was cheers and yells and cheering. It was great.
I showed up at that same event afterwards, after you had left, and people were still talking about it.
Nice. That just shows
Hot Streak
is the game. It is mascot racing. It is craziness. You have people dressed up as mascots. They're running down the track.
That's fascinating. You just tickled my philosopher brain a little bit. People dressed up as interesting.
So anyone who's worn a mask knows that you can't see very well out of it, so you could be running in the wrong direction. They're running into each other.
Occupational hazard.
They're knocking each other over. You're looking at the cards. You're sabotaging racers. You're betting. It's great.
Did Bear break your heart?
Again.
Bear will break your heart every time. How did Fish do? How's my boy Fish?
Badly?
Oh.
And it was Hurley. Hurley did. Hurley the hot dog. Mark, he had 1 card in his pile.
Interesting. How did it turn out for him?
He still did it.
Wild.
Every time.
I really want to play more Hot Streak. I regret having left the copy with you.
I lost it. I don't know where it went.
We don't have an official policy on who gets to own review copies. I'm going to have to smuggle that one out somehow.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have the game that you speak of.
No. That's too bad.
And lastly for me, same event, Flip 7. Same thing, table full of all new players. And 2 of them were on their phones trying to figure out how to order Flip 7. This is designed by Eric Olson and put out by Op Games.
You keep finding new converts to this ridiculous non-game event.
It is a press your luck, don't get the same number twice. It's a deck of cards that has 12 12s, 11 11s, down
to... See, at least in Moving Company, I get to play with some nice furniture.
Down to 0, which there's also 1 0. You either hit or stay. It has some interesting.
No, stop. Stop.
Action cards. You're freezing people. You're forcing people
to... In this case, it's mostly a joke, but in general, trolling is destroying the political fabric of this continent. I'm not joking. Anyway, go on.
I'm just saying, in a game of this light...
Sure.
And the fact that these action cards don't slow down the sort of pace of the game. They just do what they do and get over with. And they do...
Yeah, get it over with. That I think is a good tone, a good attitude.
You're either forcing...
Just gird yourself. It's like, all right, this flip seven is going to happen, but it'll end sooner or later.
You have this flip three card. You can play it on yourself or other players. Freezes, extra lives. Anyway, flip seven. Check it out.
So much regret. Those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break while we pay some bills.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
And we're back, and onto the news and why it doesn't matter. First off, Congrès. So Very Wrong About Games, Fun Times Good Vibes Only, Trans Rights a Human Rights Board Game Jamboree. Open registration remains open. It is going to be July 25th to July 27th in Kingston, Ontario, the finest Kingston, Ontario on earth. You can buy tickets on Eventbrite. There is a link in the episode notes. There's still room. We would love to have you there.
This is the limestone city. Limestone is the liminess of all stones, Mark.
Look, was I not... I get no end of crap from Kingston locals for not being sufficiently enthusiastic about this city. Was I not sufficiently praised?
I'm building on that, Mark. I want people to understand the lavishness of the limestone.
There's limestone. Yeah, yeah. We would love to see you for SwagCon. Please come join us. We're going to be playing some games. We're going to be having some minor events, but mostly games.
Mostly games.
And you will come away with free games. Because you must.
I was about to say, you will.
No, in all seriousness, we both need to seriously slim down our collection. Just one example that I added to the list recently, an all-in copy of Anachrony in the deluxe box. Yeah, that'll be there. Come get it.
I don't even want to go over there. There'll be a lot of games.
Weather Machine. Weather Machine's going to be there. Come get it. Yeah, come get some games, people.
Yeah. Tabletop Tycoon is a company... Like, we all know that Simon was having issues, and so they've decided to try to rectify that by selling off some of their assets.
Some of their IPs.
So, was this... I don't want to speculate of why Simon is in trouble. People might say tariffs. I really think that...
It's been a long... It's a strange business story. There's a lot of stuff going on.
It has not... Tariffs have only been in the last few months. I cannot see that doing this so quickly. But anyway, let's not even get into that. Anyway, some of the IPs that have now moved to Tabletop Tycoon, because we've seen this in many games like Tigris and Euphrates and games that have been published by 15 different publishers, so all sorts of different versions. So now maybe we'll get new versions of games like Blood Rage, Rising Sun, Ankh, Gods of Egypt, Arcadia Quest, Starcadia Quest. And so maybe we'll get different versions of these types of games.
All games worked on by Eric Lang. Either solo designs or co-designs in the case of the Quest games.
So, he's already hinted that he had a Blood Rage expansion sort of already in the works.
Yep.
And so now he's sort of even hinted harder that it's going to be announced soon.
The hinting is accelerating. It's reaching critical mass.
So now the questions are, Mark, there's a chance that they want to put their own edition.
Right.
So now will this expansion be made for only this new edition? Will they be made for both editions?
It's going to be a whole scene.
So who knows?
Constant question. Just the same way there's the new expansion for the new Inish. The definitive edition is up on crowdfunding, and the new expansion is kind of sort of compatible with the base game. There's a version with has the same card backs, but it has the new layout on the front, so they don't match visually once you've drawn them. Anyway, some people are fine with that. Some people object. It's hard. It's really hard when you're making a new expansion for a new edition to decide what to do and how to handle it. It's very difficult. And gamers, as a rule, never complain.
Never.
Never.
They're happy with whatever they get.
Crowdfunding. Phantom Division. It's happening.
It's out there.
By Pete Ruth and Mark Thomas, the pseudo-sequel, the development, the sci-fi version of the only game that matters, SEAL Team Flicks, is up on Kickstarter right now. We were supposed to have a gameplay video when the product launched, but there were problems with the prototype, and so alas, they don't have that ready yet. I swear this project is cursed, Walker. We'll see what happens. We in particular, are super excited about Phantom Division. They've been teasing us for years about this thing.
So what for people who do not know what SEAL Team Flicks and Phantom Division is, you are sort of an elite squad in both games. You're moving around the map using squares, and when you go to shoot at enemies with weapons, you're actually flicking discs from where your character is, and you can bounce off corners or barricades or stuff. And what the interesting thing that Phantom Division does is that there will also be a set of dice, so a sort of subsystem that people that don't enjoy flicking, they can now roll dice instead. So that I thought that was kind of interesting, because it will apply to us. Louis does not like any dexterity flicking games, so now and you can mix and match. It's not everybody uses dice, so he'll be able to roll the dice when he wants to shoot things. The rest of us will be able to flick our discs. I won't get too much into it. Anyway, yeah. Mini games.
And on top of that, a stellar selection of mini games, one of the best implementations of stealth in any game I've ever played, as well as very, very, very cleverly designed maps.
Yeah, and by mini games, we mean like, for deploying your troops, you flick these discs on a separate board, and it'll tell you where you get to deploy, or you find a bomb and you have to defuse it using a dexterity minigame, or you know, all these different interesting ways.
Why aren't we playing it right now? Where's Phantom Division?
I want to pound the table. I'm throwing Don't money at table, my screen, Walker. And
the Gibbons get nervous when you pound
Why
the table.
Why can't I play Phantom Division?
On the topic of brilliantly designed maps and really good stealth games, Sniper Elite has an expansion that is currently up on crowdfunding. Sniper Elite was co-designed by Roger Tankersley and David Thompson. Operation Kraken is now up on GameFound, which has some new maps designed by the original designers, and that makes me very enthusiastic because, again, it was about discovering those fascinating little cul-de-sacs, these cleverly designed corners, these brilliantly laid out sections that really made the game sing. It's why Sniper Elite is Survey Robot Games' favorite 1v-all game and also really manages to capture the tension of that sort of cat-and-mouse dynamic. Lovely little set pieces. Very enthusiastic about more Sniper Elite.
It adds this part of Spectrops that was really enjoyable, where you had this car that zoomed down the center of the road. So in this new Kraken expansion, there's this armored car that goes around. I'm wondering if it's going to be used sort of the same, that will help the bad guys get around the map a little faster.
I never really liked Spectrops. It's weird. Anyway, yeah. I'm not super enthusiastic about the car necessarily. I'm keen about new maps. I love seeing those new maps. It's great. Sniper Elite is really well done. So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. We now move on to our feature game, which is Rumble Nation. I am just been informed by the editorial team that it is not about the Outsiders, the Greasers versus the Sox, nor is it about the Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan in the Royal Rumble. This apparently is a game about the Sengoku Jidai, where you roll dice and deploy troops on a map of Japan.
Oh, is that like that implementation like has the new edition?
Yeah, that game we've been playing over the past few weeks.
Gotcha.
It's strangely enough. So this was designed by Yogi Shinichi, initially published by Hobby Japan in 2017. There have been a couple of editions since. The most recent edition is a very classy-looking slim box, which kind of belies how light and breezy the actual gameplay is. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Rumble Nation?
So in Rumble Nation, it's yet another one of these games that is a ton of game in a little box for a very short amount of time. It is an area control game. It has this map of Japan. So you're rolling dice. It has a two-phase game. So in the first phase, you're rolling dice, you're populating the board, and in the second phase, you're battling it out in the different sections.
I mean, basically, you play the game, and then you score the game.
And then you score the game.
So, there are no decisions to be made in this alleged second section.
There's not really battling out. This is who has the most troops. But it does change while you're battling out, because in every game, you're randomly putting out numbers that are numbered 2 through 12, and you battle out in order. And if you win, you win that token, and that's the many points. So the first battle is number 2. You'll win 2 points if you have the most troops there. But the hook of this game is that if you won, you get to send reinforcements to every adjacent territory as long as you have any presence whatsoever in them. So that's going to give you 2 troops in all of those territories. As long as you have presence, which will totally change the outcome, not every time, but has the opportunity to change the outcome in all of these, and just amplifies from there, right? As you know, then you do 3. If you win 3, then you 2 more troops again in all the adjacent areas. But the map is laid out in a certain way where sometimes there's nothing adjacent, or you need to look at the map because, you know, you get to 7 and everything surrounding 7 is, you know, 6 and a 2 and 3. And so those have already resolved. So, you know, winning 7 is not going to get you anything.
Yeah, don't plan. Well, it's going to get you the 7 points.
Yes.
But don't plan on 7 being the linchpin of winning other territories. But if there's a low number territory, like a 4, that happens to be surrounded by a bunch of other territories, you go into 4 not for the 4 points. You go into 4 to win those other territories. Because one of my relative dissatisfactions with Rumble Nation is that the 10, 11, the 12, they are very consequential. And a number of times I've seen people engage in the far more interesting play of using the 5 to win the 8, which wins them the 9 or something. It's like, ooh, I'm jockeying for all these. Meanwhile, somebody else just dumps a whole bunch of pieces in 10, 11, and 12 and runs away with a massive quantity of points and more or less ignores all this issue of reinforcements. And that's okay. I mean, it's not a huge problem, but it's just one of those things where you made a comparison the first time we talked about Rumble Nation, and upon reflection, I think it actually is quite astute in one way, and that is you compared it to Dominion. Typically in a game of Dominion, you look at the 10 action cards that are available, and you make a couple of key decisions about what action cards you want, you ignore everything else, and you watch the game play out. And in Rumble Nation, that's more or less similar, except you can't control which provinces you're going to get into. You do have to remain flexible and accept the fact that, yeah, you'd really like to dump a whole bunch of people into that 5 because the 5 could be a linchpin to a bunch of points. But if you don't roll the right combinations, you're not going to get into 5. And so you might have to shift gears in that sense.
You do get a reroll every turn. So you have a second chance every time to get into that 5, like you said. And there's also this set of action cards that will be N+1 on the side of the board. And when it is your turn, you have an opportunity to use one of those cards instead of rolling the dice. But as soon as someone has deployed all of their troops, that closes down any card play for the rest of the game. And then the rest of the players, you know, roll until they've deployed all of their units. And then the battle begins.
Also known as phase 2 of gameplay, according to Michael Walker. You know that I love some good tempo manipulation, and that is one of the bits that I was very surprised by in Rumble Nation in a pleasant way. Because typically in games of this length, you don't see much tempo considerations. But whether you're playing the advanced game, which introduces a new kind of special power, or just the base game, which also has these action cards, in either case, the moment somebody is out of pieces, the cards are out of play. Nobody gets to do anything with cards anymore. And so even though they don't necessarily tend to be earth-shaking in their application, they are very consequential. But it's an area majority game. You always want to do these things last. You always want to do them after you've seen everyone else commit their forces. And so you start looking at everyone else's supplies, and Walker's only got 3 left. He might go out next turn, but maybe he won't. Do I use this card or do I chuck in more guys and hope? Anyway, those kinds of considerations and those calculations, I think, are really well done for a game of this length. Typically only see that kind of tension in longer games.
And piled on top of that is the fact that because you're sort of populating the board with the same number of troops as everyone else, there are chances of ties. And whoever goes out first gets the sword token with the highest swords on it. And then it just goes down from there. And that's going to win ties. So the sooner you get your troops out, the more chances you have of winning all of these ties.
And so what could be, and in some cases is, a very, very, very straightforward calculation. It's like, I have put 5 guys in this province. Someone else put 3. I win first, they take second. You end up in these circumstances where it's like, okay, I've got a 2-person advantage there now. I don't know what else they're going to be putting in there. If I go out now, though, I'll win the tie, and then they'll have to put 3 out there. Based on the number of supplies they've got left, that's not very likely. And this calculation is applying simultaneously to a whole bunch of different competitions where you're going, because the piece count is sufficiently parsimonious that you don't tend to see many blowouts. Typically, you win a province by a couple of figures or more. That also makes the reinforcements super consequential if they happen to line up in the right way. Now, as a result, you can end up in these situations where you really outsmart yourself. And sometimes there's the temptation to do that. Again, lean on this cool steamroller. But the problem is, if you pull out a single linchpin in there, then it typically falls apart in catastrophic fashion, as you, on occasion, have discovered.
True. And just to go into the dice again, just in case people want to know how this works, you're going to roll 3 dice, and then you sort of pair them up. The 2 dice are going to be where the troops are going to go.
The province is 2 through 12. As you can imagine, it's much easier to place in 6, 7, 8 than it is in 2 and 12.
And then the other D6 is how many troops. It's either going to be 1, 2, or 3. So it's sort of like a D3. You know, 1, 2, 1, 3, 4, 2, 5, 6, 3.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed with how often the dice combinations leave you with very, very few choices. And yes, you can reroll, but that's basically substituting one grouping of not many choices with another grouping of not many choices. And if you roll doubles, that goes, that's doubly so. Yeah. Triples will, of course, on occasion happen, but not very frequently. So it's more about, you know, massaging the tempo, using the special powers, making those key decisions about what provinces are going to be important. Sadly, again, 10, 11, 12 being vastly more important than the other ones. And that's effectively your game of Rumble Nation. And the thing is, though, if you're going to play Rumble Nation, you have to be willing to commit. It's a substantial chunk of your life. The rules explanation takes about 5 whole minutes. That's 5 minutes, Walker. Oof. That's 300 seconds.
Oh my God.
You're never getting those back.
How many pages is that rule book?
Like, oh, it's a dense tome. Oof. Without any pictures in it. Oh. And then when you actually start playing a full 4-player game, I don't know, that's like another 20, 25 minutes, Walker.
That's too long, Mark.
Look, I don't make the rules.
And that's with the module that we have yet to talk about.
That is with the advanced rules. For hardcore gamers, they don't express it that way in the rule book.
So the advanced rules is just a bunch of Daimyo cards that you're going to draft at the beginning of the game, which, much like the action cards, instead of rolling the dice on a turn, you're going to use your Daimyo card, which usually has something to do with where you've placed your Daimyo, which is a bigger meeple.
He's really huge. I don't know what he's been eating.
Which counts as 2 troops when calculating the battle. And so the Daimyo cards do much like the action cards do, let you know, move troops around slightly into other adjacent, you know, territories, mix it up a little bit. And I think both cards are adequately interesting and balanced, in my opinion.
It's just the right level of spice. We were talking earlier in 23 Knives how we wanted just a little bit more, right? Or I did anyway. And I think that Rumble Nation is a good example of just the right level of spice. The cards, when you see the cards laid out, they don't seem immediately spectacular. It's like move a couple units across the land border. But the thing is, in conjunction with how the dice rolls shake out, and in conjunction with these tempo considerations that I talked about before, they do lead to surprisingly difficult trade-offs on your turn, especially when you really want to either put out more guys really fast or hang back. It gives you another option. It's another way to do it. Sometimes you're never going to use a card. Sometimes you use your Daimyo but not an action card, or vice versa, or no cards at all. All of those I've seen be very viable, and that I think is a testament to how they've been calibrated.
Like you said, the 11, 12s are very powerful areas to control, but you don't roll them very much. Like one of the games that I played, some people have rolled them but ended up re-rolling. So 11 and 12 were just empty and not even scored.
Yeah, that makes it worse, though. Because they show up so seldom, if you get a couple, 1 or 2 lucky rolls where you're able to dump like 3 figures into a 10, 11, or a 12.
True, I'm just saying this is what I'm trying to get at, is that this is where the cards will help you out. Because
yes,
they will help you get into those odd numbered areas that will help you either solidify them or put them into contention.
Well, no, 10 and 12 are even numbers, Walker.
Yes, Mark, you are correct. They are even numbers.
Oh, sorry, I'm getting a call. Oh, Board Game Geek wants the Golden Geek back. They say you can keep yours, but I have to give mine back.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that, you know what? That's fair.
The tracks.
Yeah, yeah. That suits it. Yeah, so again, these are clever little exploits that you can massage to your advantage very much in the same way that noticing the order of the provinces and being able to take advantage of that can really make a subpar placement into a good placement long term. And again, the timing is tricky. Like, for example, I had a daimyo power that allowed me to convert adjacent figures, but only one, which is super powerful, but only if one figure makes the difference. So naturally, you want to wait to see how this is going to shake out. You can't wait too long, though, because if you wait too long, you can't use it at all. So I really like those tempo tensions.
True, but convert is a difference of two. Like, I was looking at the
card. No, it's really powerful, again, yeah. But it's only one. If someone's got three or four figures there, you can't dislodge them with the result of this power.
No.
You have to put in the work, and you have to, very much the same way that these reinforcements, a crucial condition of those reinforcements is that you already have to be present in the province. So yeah, you won the six, and the six is next to the 12, but you need to be in the 12 in the first place, again, making... kind of relying on some of those lucky rolls. Whatever. It's a 20-minute long dice game.
Yeah. And the setup...
There are good rolls and bad rolls. Not a huge deal.
And the setup is dead simple. And the fact that the numbers go out on the map, like, randomly every time, so it sort of changes up. You know, there are a few, you know, sort of dead-end territories, you know, so where the numbers sort of end up does change how it, you know, pans out. So it does make it, I don't want to say it's super interesting that the numbers are different every game, but it does make a difference in some ways.
Yeah, it changes the contours of the geography. Yeah.
And you put out the cards and you're ready to go, and cleaning up is just as fast. It's such a fast, simple game that I just very much enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a little themeless. It's a little lacking on visual and thematic flair. So it gets its charm mostly by virtue of the economy of its playtime and the occasional moments of cleverness and tension from the tempo and the action cards. It's very well designed. It is an exceptionally good filler. I don't think it is necessarily any better than that. It's not, you know, the filler that feels like a full game. I don't feel like I've had a full game experience upon playing it. But I will say I've never begrudged any moment I've spent with Rumble Nation. It is extraordinarily well done. And if you've got four or fewer players, a great little... suits all the normal useful functions of a filler, waiting for someone else to show up, last thing to do at the end of a game event. It is extraordinarily well done, highly recommended for those purposes.
Agreed. Rumble Nation.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so, so very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We really appreciate it. Your most valuable resource is your time. We respect that, and we appreciate that you decided to share some of that with us. We hope to see you again soon. Please do take care of yourself. Self-care is a moral obligation. And take care of your hobby.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a Real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a Real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your Real ID at tsa.gov/realid. That's tsa.gov/realid. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.